So the book title, Caught in a Riptide, it's about your own personal journey after your husband passed away and you embarked on a solo travel. Can you give us a bit of a synopsis of what readers can expect?
Going back to the title, it's Caught in a Riptide, but if you look at it, it's RIP in capitals and then tide, which actually represents the sort of the RIP is the fact that I lost my mother 3 months before my husband, and then my husband and my dog. So it was a case of sort of RIP suggests, you know, the losses, and then it actually fitted with the word riptide quite well. And riptide is very much the sort of Australian analogy of being pulled back and forth in a strong current, and I was in Australia, so that's why it's the rip is RIP, but it obviously translates as riptide. It was written, it was not intended to be a book. It was, I've always written, but you're usually for myself. And I, as I suggest over there, well, I went over to Australia to be with our daughter after my husband died, who lives over there, and wanted to go on a, I needed to get away. I needed to reach depths that I knew I needed to reach of grief where I wasn't helped by anybody. I didn't want anybody trying to make me better. And the obvious place was to stay in Australia because of its sheer beauty and vastness. And if you can't begin to heal in a place like that, then I don't think you would anywhere. We were heading into the English winter when I left. It was just becoming autumn, and it frightened me, to be honest. The darkness, the length of the days. I'd taken early retirement, so the days were long anyway, let alone being at home at 4 o'clock in the dark and then a long night ahead. So I yearned for sort of light and space and freedom and an opportunity to go somewhere where I could just be totally myself and yet nobody knew me. And it so that just sort of followed. And I started writing for myself in Tasmania. I went to Tasmania and it was such a most beautiful spot. I had a chalet very close to the beach and it just inspires you. And I started writing. I had read The Salt Path, which is a well-known book about a couple that lost everything and went traveling. And it was and I just, that came back to me, and I thought, this is the style of writing I really like. They're writing a true, honest story. I went through the sort of imposter syndrome as who wants to really honestly read about the details of my life, but you get past that because if you read any book, that's exactly what you're reading and enjoying is the minutiae of people's lives, so you can get lost in their thoughts and their experiences. So it grew from Tasmania, and I kept writing every day. It's very honest, emotionally, often funny experiences that I had. And when I didn't look back on any of it until I came home in the January, 5 months later, and then I looked back on it, and at first you think, oh, I've got to change this and that, but then you step back and think, no, because that was actually written in the moment at the time, and those emotions were real. So the only changes I made were obvious ones to tense, grammar, spelling, and maybe the layout so that it flowed better for another reader. And it made itself, to be quite honest, without sounding too fanciful. I met people at the right time who were interested in helping me self-publish, so proofreaders and designers. My brother-in-law's a printer, so he took it on for me. And a year to the day that I arrived in Australia, August the 23rd last year, August the 23rd this year, my first box of actual books arrived. So that was really lovely because I didn't, it felt like longer than a year, and I almost had to double check myself and think, surely it's taken longer, but it was just a process that flowed beautifully.
That's nice that it came full circle like that.
It was weird. It was, honestly, the doors that opened after Richard died were incredible. And I had laid myself bare in the sense that I gave up. I retired 2 days before I went travelling. We used to work together, Richard and I, and I just couldn't face working there without him. It was too hard. So I basically took my life back to zero, absolute zero. My children are grown up and didn't need, you know, daily attention, and work was sorted. My husband wasn't there. My mother wasn't there. It was scary because you suddenly have an awful lot of space to fill. And it's almost as scary as having too much on your mind, you know, when your mind's exploding with all those things. And but when you take them all away, you've got to start refilling that space. And slowly, slowly, I have, and the book has been a tremendous part of that.
Mm-hmm. I think it must be daunting at any age or regardless of your situation to go travelling solo. Did you have any moments where you thought, oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm actually doing this?
It was very strange, and it came with its the good thing is I've never minded flying or travelling or booking stuff. I never felt that wasn't a problem at all. But the first beach I went to, when I was sort of doing a bit of a dry run, when I went to a beach near Perth, so that I wasn't that far from my daughter, I went away for a weekend, and I walked onto the beach, and it was the most beautiful beach. And I stood there and I absolutely stopped still and thought, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. I don't know whether to turn left or right or sit down or stand up, because the dynamic of a couple is that you've always got somebody going, oh, let's go and have a cup of tea. Let's go and have a drink. So we're going to have some lunch. Let's go here. Let's go there. And I didn't have it. And I felt absolutely devastated because I thought, this is horrible. I'm so, so alone. But then again, that was the whole point of the exercise. So I sort of had to embrace it. But I just walked back to the hotel and lay on the bed looking at the ceiling for the next day. And then the next day I came out. And of course, that feeling had been dealt with. And so it was the next feeling. So then you said, well, go and have a coffee. And then you sit and people watch. And day by day, you just do get used to it. But I don't think you ever get used to it, but you could put it in a place where it's okay. But I just always remember that first feeling, and that really was daunting. But I knew that in my heart, that was the whole point. That's what I'd set out to do. And I was glad to be able to embrace those feelings.
So the book launch is raising funds for a number of charities, some of them being Bowel Cancer UK, and the Royal Marsden Hospital. Yeah. What was the support like and the treatment from the Royal Marsden when Richard was a patient there?
Outstanding. From day one, I was there from day one when he got the diagnosis. Beyond that, he was pretty much there on his own. And that was a choice because it was his journey. He needed to be in control of it. That was the best way that he could deal with it. He didn't need a wife sort of asking questions and poking and prodding. He was a very deep man. He didn't show his emotions readily, but a place like that became like a second home, and he knew the people on first name terms, and he could talk, and he'd come home full of it, in a sense that it became his world, and it wasn't mine to interfere with. I only really got involved when a specialist was called or he asked me to go, but on the whole it was his world. The way that they looked after him, I was absolutely outstanding. I mean, there wasn't that you would have thought he was the only patient there. The from every day and right up until the end, their compassion and their honesty and was just amazing. They kept offering him scans and tests when it was obvious it was hopeless, but they didn't just cast him aside or think, oh well. They were absolutely 100% right until the last day. They were superb, and included me obviously as necessary, but without, there was no fuss, and there was no, you always felt welcomed and not pushed around or a number. And when you see the number of people in the waiting room, quite often you just think, how do they keep that composure with all these people, such an emotional time, and they manage to make you feel special. So I've got a massive amount of time for the Marsden. The book definitely, this first launch, this first run of books, is £1 goes to Royal Marsden and £1 goes to Bowel Cancer UK, as that was his cancer. In the future, I will always donate to cancer charities. They may be different. I will always be giving to the Marsden, but I'd like to include smaller cancer charities as well. But on the Marsden was always be the closest to my heart, because we are very lucky in the sense that we live 3 minutes away. And I mean, there's people that travel worldwide, countrywide to go.
Yeah.
So we were blessed. There's no doubt about it.
You're so right about that. You often forget, because it's just down the road from many of us in Southwest London. We forget just how amazing
just
as
signs.
A cancer
you never
treatment.
Think, yeah. You never think it'll be you going there. But, you know, that was just the icing on the cake, and people knew that. And That and work, which was very close by, we were very lucky. We were lucky people. I'm not denying it. So, the Marston's a big part of my art.
And just finally, you're launching Caught in a Riptide on Friday in Banstead on the High Street. Where can readers get their hands on the book if they're not able to attend?
The book is live on Amazon. It went live on the 2nd. It does say it's slightly confusing because at the moment, because the books have been sent to them, but there's obviously a time that we didn't factor in to when they have to sort of log the stock. So when you go onto Amazon, it says available in March, which is a bit daunting, but that will change within the next day or two, and it will be available on Amazon Prime from then on. And it's also, I do have an Instagram, which is Freebird Reflections, which is all about the book, and it, all the details for buying the book will be available on there. So they should be able to get on there, no problem at all.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant. Thank you so much for talking to me today.
That's right.
I think it's just, I'm really excited to actually get my hands on a copy because I think it's so inspiring, the journey with grief and overcoming. And I think quite interesting the comparison to, you know, losing a partner, a lifelong partner, and also embarking on that solo travel, facing two very quite stark realities in that sense. But really appreciate you talking with me today, Judy.
It highlights the fact it did. I mean, Richard was a doer. You know, he was desperate to live, and he was desperate to raise more money. And he would be so cross if I was wasting my life. And that was always on my shoulder. I thought, you know, I've got to honour the life that he didn't want to leave. That's the simple fact. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of things that I've learned along the way, but he was an amazing example to follow. I'm lucky. And if I can help or, you know, relate to anybody, then I would have loved to have read something along the same lines. So it's just a positive spin on what we're dealing with, really.
Yeah. I'm sure lots of people will find comfort in it if they're going in a
very similar situation. I think so, because you know, there's three losses in there. I mean, even as simple as I say at the end, it's a pet or a partner or a parent. It's the same loss is loss. Very different losses, but loss is huge and it can be very daunting and disabling in a way. And that's life does go on, and you never think it will, and you don't want to say that because it sounds very sort of cliche. But if you want your life to go on, you really got to make it go on the best way possible, and therefore if you can help others, then surely that's the main reason.